once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead. Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Thank you for stirring us some more. Thank you very much.
Was that better?
Yes.
All right.
Okay. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, not an adaption of Henry V's scene at the Battle of Harfleur. We will be talking about finance rather than dead English people in walls.
Well, I'm going to talk about English people and what the dead English people.
Well, and how the
and live English people.
Yes. So Brexit will come into the conversation at some point today. So it may sound a bit like Harfleur's threat.
Well, then we could simply say, I'll fill the aisle up with English dead.
Right. Which they do naturally over their lifetime.
Right. Over a period of time. They bury them.
Or, yes. Yeah. So this is the Personal Wealth Coach. Speaking to you right now is Jake McClure, or let's say this correctly, with Jake and
Jeff
McClure. Between us, we are bald.
And bearded.
And bearded. Yes, that too.
And have genetic similarities.
We are going to be talking to you today about the world of finance, personal finance and macro finance. Macro finance being big finance rather than macro photography, which is small photography, but made big.
Oh, boy.
Yes. Yeah. Before we get started, we must give you more disclosures other than the one about us being bald and bearded. You should have probably picked up by now that we are word nerds, or maybe just nerds. So that's another disclosure. The next is that the Personal Wealth Coach, the name of this program, is not coincidentally also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm registered to give fiduciary advice and management. This is not fiduciary advice and management on the radio, though. The two people on the radio are the same two people that work over that other firm giving advice, but we can't give advice on the air. So hopefully what you're hearing today is educational. It may simply be boring, but...
Well, let me make an exception. I can give advice on the air.
So you're going to be exceptionalistic? Go ahead.
No, I'm going to say that the air is warm and you don't need a coat when you go outside, so I wouldn't wear one. That's advice on the air.
No, you just said what you would do. So that's educational. I do not recommend that you wear a coat in the heat of August in Texas. That's advice.
That's advice on the air.
Yeah.
Right. The air is hot.
Yeah. Or yes, the air is hot.
We're contributing to the hot air.
We spew hot air at a rate that is faster than most carbon emitting plants. Yes.
Right. Exactly.
All right.
Okay,
so
we got that out of the way.
Educational. You want to add something to that about deeming?
Well, the information we provide on this educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable. However, we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
And just because the firm's registered with the SEC doesn't mean that the SEC has any kind of approval mechanism in its bureaucratic body. It does not believe that we are better than someone else because we are registered. The SEC is famous for not approving much of anything. So please don't take an inference that we're registered with them that somehow they think we're cool or uncool or anything else except that we're registered with them. And last but not least, one method of our communication reaching the ears of you, our wonderful listener, is through Studio KTEM 1400. We do not pay to have this program, nor are we paid to do the program. We've been doing this program. I've been on the program with you since 1998. Unpaid, you actually had a year and a half or so of doing the program by yourself before that. So we've been doing this a long time. The firm that we mentioned a moment ago does buy advertisement on the studios, on the station. But the advertisement is for the radio program, which is a little weird. And the studio also advertises the program. We do pay market rates for our advertising. There. No discounts or anything like that, which is, you know, they might want to give us a discount at some point, but we wouldn't accept it because that would be us paying for the radio program. Strange, or not, or being paid for the radio. I don't know how to even look at it. There may be a quid pro quo in there if you speak Latin, but there isn't one here.
Senator, there is no quid pro quo.
I do not recall that, Senator.
All right.
Yes.
You know, we date ourselves pretty severely by saying that.
Yes.
Because that is from Watergate.
Yeah. Yep.
And people, and I said that to somebody who is considerably younger than I am the other day, who I considered to be a very well mature male person. He said, I wasn't born during Watergate.
I wasn't either.
I wasn't alive during Watergate. Yeah. I said, oh, well, that kind of explains why you didn't understand what I just said. Yeah. Matter of fact, I was in a meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission of the village of Salado, and there was a mature man who is an alderman in the, which means older man in the village, who is part of our, part of this task force I'm on. And I said, well, I've been here since 1972. And he said, I haven't been since 1972 even.
Yep.
I thought, you made me feel really old. Made me feel really old.
The good thing about dating yourself is you never have to question who's going to pick up the check.
That's right. You get to pay for it every time.
Yeah.
So I suppose we should move on to the markets.
Yes. What happened this week?
The stock market was all week. Marketing stocks.
Okay.
Didn't see anything more.
Actually, it didn't move much except with the rotation of the planet. It stayed in New York pretty much.
The New York Stock Exchange stayed there, but actually most of the trading is done someplace else now. And that we could talk about that, but we won't.
But we will go into the detail of what actually happened in the market rather than our silliness about it.
Market was kind of churning along during the week, up and down a little bit like it normally does in normal times, which these aren't. And then on Friday morning, a guy in blue jeans in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, wearing blue jeans and a plaid shirt with a blue jacket over it, gave a speech. And the guy with the blue jeans and the plaid shirt and the blue jacket, whose name is Jerome Powell. Goodness, would you hate to go through life? Jerome, how are you today? Anyway, he thinks he's chairman of the Federal Reserve Board Open Market. And he made a speech, and it the various market, major market indices typically lost about 4% immediately. What he said was that, guys, we have been telling you that the Federal Reserve is going to raise rates until we crush inflation. We're not going to back off because unemployment goes up. We're not going to back off because the economy slows down. We want the economy to slow down. This is going to be painful, and it is going to hurt badly some people. But that's the price you pay when you crush inflation, and that's our job, is inflation crushing. So until we get inflation crushed and we're convinced it's going to stay crushed, we are going to aggressively raise interest rates and leave them up there, which is what he has been saying for 6 months.
Or more. Yeah, he started saying it the month before 6 months ago to say, yeah, we're going to do this.
And no, the a lot of investors apparently didn't believe him.
Caused and a little bit of a shock, yeah.
Right. And so the question arises, and I've had this many times, why does raising short-term interest rates cause the price of stocks to go down? Well, it doesn't. First, there's a herd mentality out there where people sell stocks because somebody else is selling stocks, and that's the main reason stocks go up and down.
There's double meaning here. I heard someone was selling stocks, so I'm going to join the herd and sell stocks.
Right.
Yes.
Herd, yes. What it boils down to is the S&P 500, for example, is led in its movements, and a big chunk of its value, because it's valued by capitalization, and capitalization means how much money is the total value of the stocks of a company. So the large capitalization, the stocks on the New York Stock Exchange or the S&P 500 that have the highest total valuation are largely what are called large growth companies. And those companies are priced on the market based on their expected earnings growth into the future. Well, if they've got a lot of loans outstanding, and growth companies typically do have a lot of loans outstanding because they're borrowing money to expand their capacity so they can sell more stuff so they can grow, then the cost of borrowing money is going to go up if interest rates go up, which takes money out of their earnings. It's like if you look at your net cash flow every month, that would be considered, if you were a corporation, your earnings. In other words, what you make at work or wherever you get your money, minus all your expenses. And if among those are that's what's for, if you were a corporation, that would be called your earnings. In other words, your excess cash flow each month. And if you look at your excess cash flow and you say, it's very nice and I should be highly valued. And if I were a stock company, then my stock would be very expensive. But you have about a lot of floating interest rate loans. And the interest rates are floating up. Life is going to get more expensive for you.
Yeah, let's call them credit cards with low interest rates, but floating interest rates. You got good credit. So they're not charging you 30%, but their rates are going up now.
It's kind of like you had a variable rate mortgage, big variable rate mortgage. And pretty clearly from what the Federal, and it was based on what the Federal Reserve charges people for money, and it's going up very quickly. And the interest rates are going up, which means your earnings are going to go down, which means your stock is worthless. Not worthless, but worth less.
Right.
Well, anyway.
And some people go, worthless. That means worthless. Right. That's the panic.
It's good to keep this in context. And I think it's, and excuse me, I'm doing more than just basic market reporting here, but I think it's really good to keep this in context.
Okay.
The stocks, the average price per share based on capitalization weighting, and you can go into that if you want to, dropped about 4% for the week. That's pretty minor. And why is that pretty minor and pretty insignificant? Well, if you're an investor, virtually by definition, you are a long-term investor, which means 3 years is almost short. 3 years is the minimum time you should look to be an investor. The S&P 500 stock index is up 47% over the last 3 years, which is an astonishingly high rate of return, much higher than historical averages. It's a major, if you look at it over a three-year period, it's clearly we're in a major bull market. It's thoroughly impressive. Matter of fact, the average annual rate of return over the last 3 years for the SPX is 13.05% per year. Wow. And people are really upset saying the market's down. Well, maybe to short-term folks, the market is down, but to long-term folks, the market is distinctly up. And keep that in mind and keep focused on that, because that's the important thing. Anyway, let's go on. So the S&P 500 dropped 4.04% for the week, but it's still 10.66, rounded to 11%, higher than it was in mid-June. It's 15% lower than it was early January. So it's doing pretty well. It's continuing to turn along. Now, we follow another index called the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index, and I've explained before why we think that's an important one to follow, too. It fell 3.16% for the week. It's down 7.86% from its high, and it's up 10.12% from its low point in June. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note rose just a little bit to 3.04%. And 3% for the Treasury note is not too bad. Now, the problem that people are complaining about, and I question that it's really a problem at this point, is that the 2-year note is at 3.37. That makes for an inverted yield curve, which in about 60 to 80% of historical cases, an inverted yield curve results in a recession within 18 months. Is this normal times? No. I think that signal is probably, we could have a recession. We could have a recession at any time. But the fact is, that doesn't mean what it traditionally has meant.
We're going to go into more detail on that later. Yeah. It's some really fascinating stuff.
I want to answer a question from Roger real quickly.
It's a very nice question. You want me to prep it for you so you can answer it?
You can say it.
Roger, thank you for the question. John, we're going to get to you in just a minute. This is one that has to do with the disclosures. So Roger says, on a lighter note, Jeff, did you craft the Deem disclosure or was it by a lawyer?
Roger, I crafted that. I crafted it tongue in cheek. I have read so much lawyerese. I read prospectuses. I have read so much lawyerese over the years that every once in a while I enjoy speaking in lawyerese just to hear those archaic words roll off the tip of my tongue. Actually, that particular phrase says what we wanted to say about the facts that we, or the information that we present in a very concise way. It would take a paragraph to explain what that one sentence says, which is why lawyers use Latin. It's kind of like this, Roger, here's the big thing. With a lawyer or with a doctor, If you have an appointment with them and they suddenly lapse into Latin, you're in trouble.
Yep. Yep. I would agree with that. We need to do our disclosures in Latin. That would be fantastic. Ooh, it would cover all the spectrum. It would be detailed in a very short way. It'd be amazing. Nobody would understand it, but who's to say anybody understands disclosures anyway?
Well, the lawyers would understand it.
Well, I think the lawyers like to write it in a way that the lawyers can even misunderstand. That's the whole point, I think.
Yeah.
All right. So we've got another question from Inquisitor John. John, I can't thank you enough. I will continue to thank you. You send in fantastic questions. They are fattening, even. They are so delicious. So thank you. His question is, as usual, accompanied by a digital picture from his phone of the paper version of the Wall Street Journal, that we may verify that the digital version is the same or slightly different than the analog conversion to digital. All right, his question has to do with an article that says, "Some Democrats Cools to Student Debt Plan" in the Wall Street Journal. That's the headline. It's an article by Natalie Andrews, and he's got a section circled or boxed. A CNBC poll released earlier this week showed 59% of Americans were worried that forgiving student loan debt could make inflation worse. His question is, how would loan forgiveness fuel inflation? This is a good question. Anyone who's listened over the last year or so has heard us talking about inflation being made up of many variables, thousands of variables, maybe more. Because there's a lot of people out there, maybe as many variables as people can make inflation. So I'm going to answer this with the premise that maybe it can cause inflation. But then I'll give you the flip side, because economists can never give you a straight answer. So what could cause inflation over a student loan forgiveness? Let's make an imaginary person. If you imagine this imaginary person, they have a student loan that's about to be forgiven. This loan is to be paid back over a 10-year period. This loan is roughly $300 a month. And a big chunk of that's forgiven. So instead of $300 a month, they're now paying $50 a month. $50 a month? What are they doing with $250 extra dollars that they were spending on student loans? Well, they might be going out and buying things that you want to buy and causing the prices to go up. So yes, it could have a inflationary impact. There's an extra stream of income available to be spent that was being spent elsewhere. Well, now here's the other side. Where was the money going that was being paid to this student loan? Well, the ones that are being forgiven are all federally backed student loans. Well, what does that mean? It means it's a loan from the federal government. And the government was spending that extra $250 on something. Now, they are likely to continue spending that $250 through borrowing, except that our spending is down this year. We're still borrowing to do it, where you can see the variables are starting to multiply. Is it possible that the human with the extra $250 is going to spend that money more wisely than the government? It is possible, maybe even probable. So it could be that it goes the opposite direction. So this is one of those things, when people have excess money, it really depends on if they're spending it or holding on to it as to whether or not it's adding to inflation. Holding on to it or investing it, putting it away for longer term, is non-inflationary. It's actually, it stimulates growth in the economy. Spending it immediately also stimulates growth in the economy, but also rises prices on the thing that as demand goes up. Okay, you have something to add.
What was the dollar income cap on that forgiveness, the highest dollar
income? I'd have to look. It's for a married couple, it's $250,000. I think it's $139,000. I'd have to look at it again for single people.
As far as it being inflationary, that's a political issue. It has nothing to do with reality. In fact, the amount of money involved here, while it looks big, is such a tiny drop in the bucket in our economy that it is really insignificant. And what it boils down to is some college-educated people who were probably struggle. The people that's going to affect the most are the people who have a college education that's not worth the paper it's written on, that are struggling flipping burgers at McDonald's or something like that, who are going to be able to just barely pay their electric bill or their credit card payments. And is it going to have an effect on them? Yes. Are they going to go out and spend a bunch more money? No. Yeah. Because they don't have a bunch more money to spend. Now, if you're making $200,000 and you get a forgiveness that makes you not have to pay a $250 bill, I really don't think that's going to make a big difference in your spending.
Yeah.
You might go out to eat one time extra in celebration, or you might not.
So what we're looking at here, let's take a step back from that question about whether or not it will fuel inflation and get to kind of the cusp of the argument. Not left-wing, not right-wing economics. What is the cusp here? This is a loan forgiveness. Okay, who's the loan from? From the federal government. Sort of like Paycheck Protection was from the federal government. There's a difference in context. The Paycheck Protection Program was during a possible... It was during a catastrophic financial event to the economy. It was, in essence, insurance to pay back where insurance isn't going to cover a pandemic. So the United States government stepped in as an insurance provider for businesses. Some people committed insurance fraud. You see that pop up again and again. They don't call it insurance fraud with the PPP. They call it loan fraud, where people paid off their house instead of paying their employees, things like that. Bought a Lamborghini, didn't actually have any employees. This is insurance fraud in a different context. Okay, so in order to talk about these, because whataboutism falls on both sides of the political spectrum, it doesn't apply at all to economics. So what about the Paycheck Protection? You took that loan and you're upset about somebody else being forgiven when you got this much. That's whataboutism. It's different stuff. Let's not do that. You can do it on both sides of the spectrum, and it doesn't have anything to do with the math. So let's get down to the math. In some ways, this investment by the government could be looked at with the same growth potential as infrastructure. Now, I'm saying in some ways here, because there's a lot more at stake, a lot of different interests involved. But, you know, if we build a highway, some of that money is going to be lost to all the middle companies between the actual contractor and the government. So they've got special ways of doing their bids with the right number of minorities and all. So there's some, in other countries, that might be called graft. It's more bureaucratic friction here. In order to get bids done correctly, you have to lose some money to the way the bid is done. Okay, so it's kind of the cost of doing business. Other places, they just bribe people. Here, nobody's directly bribed. We just have lots of people in between the buyer and the seller. Infrastructure still adds to our capacity to do business. So does education. So forgiving a loan for education might inspire people to go to college. And I've heard people online and on video saying things like, this is just going to cause people to not care if they take a little bit more student loans. And I think you haven't taken a student loan lately if you've said that. Because just because it's forgiven once doesn't make people think, oh, the government's just going to forgive all my debt. Nope, they are still paying that stuff. They still don't like it. So the fact that the federal government is subsidizing education universally with low interest loans is one of those things we've talked about in the past where the government is stimulating new technology. It can have a positive impact if you're saying, hey, we're going to give you money for research. There's going to be graft, there's going to be misspending and malpractice involved there, but it can stimulate research. Versus giving a subsidy for buying something, which causes that technology to kind of slow down. It's good for short periods, like say, hey, everybody should buy a solar panel this year. You'll get X amount off of the price because we'll just give it to you. That will stimulate a bunch of solar growth. But if you just leave that thing in place for 10 years, it causes the solar companies to not progress in their research because they don't have to because they got free money coming in. Or in the case of education, it causes prices to go up.
Could I add something?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think the loan forgiveness will have any effect on inflation or spending at all. Here's why. From a political position, too, Donald Trump suspended student loan payments during the pandemic.
Yep.
They are still suspended, so people are not making payments on the loan and have not been making payments on the loan for 2.5 years.
So it's in essence as if those loans were forgiven $10,000 2.5 years ago.
Right. And the issue is the fact that they're not going to have to resume the payments won't change their spending habits, because over the last 2.5 years, they've not been making the payments.
And that's really the core of the inflation question. If it would have caused inflation, it's already done it, because those payments haven't been made. So that stream of income, that theoretical imaginary person's $250 that he's about to not have to pay, he's already not been paying that for 2.5 years. So what does that mean? Well, we've already experienced whatever inflation from that we would experience. We're not adding to that now. In fact, we're lessening that now, because we're not forgiving all student debt, only 10,000 of it. And right. The payment for student debt is going to start back up for everyone in October.
So which it's means this inflationary situation, not an inflationary situation.
And it doesn't even have to do with the executive order that is disinflationary. It was set to start paying back. So this is the deal, is that this is purely political as far as the inflation aspect of it is concerned, because any inflation's already occurred from this. And it didn't occur from Joe Biden. It occurred from Donald Trump, if it added inflation at all. So if you want to blame a political party, there's enough to go around. The reality is that we're talking about forgiving debt. And the end result of that is the net worth of the United States government just lowered. There's a large amount of student loan debt measured in trillions of dollars that is one end of a balance scale against the debt that the U.S. government owes mostly the United States citizens. So there's enough student debt that is owed to the U.S. government to outweigh foreign government-owned debt of the U.S. government. So like if you think, what would happen if China just dumped all of its U.S. debt on the market? Well, we've got more student debt owed to the government than China owes debt, than we owe China. So forgiving that isn't even really lowering that amount tremendously. We're talking about a couple of $100 billion coming down. That's a lot of money to you and I, but for the federal government, when they're talking measuring this debt in trillions, it's a small percentage. This isn't to say that the government should go around just forgiving all debt, but we definitely need to look at where the debt is and why it's there, because a lot of the rising cost of college comes from this direct subsidy in debt, in that if you need a student loan and you're going to college, you can get that student loan. You don't have an income. Well, you're going to college. So here, have some money, and no regard to what you're getting it for. It's because it's from the government. If it were a private corporation, they would say, well, we want to see that you're studying something that you could, that you're actually going to have an income to pay this back for, and not none of this English literature study stuff that you've got going on here. They're never going to get a job doing that. Well, the federal government says, I don't know what you're going to use it for, but here, have some money and you can pay me back. That sounds great, except that a private company's debt can be absolved in bankruptcy, where the federal government debt, that's really hard to get rid of. It's like owing debt to the IRS. If the federal government says you owe me money on this student loan and you say, well, I'm bankrupt, and they say, I don't care. So there are different types of approaches to this. The fact that we've had a high college price inflation over the entirety of my life, since when you went to college, we've had pretty much an upward trajectory on prices for college, way above normal inflation. It's measured in the 6% range at a time when inflation was measured in the 2 to 3% range. So prices have gone up there in a similar way to medical care, which basically, if you're in an emergency situation, medical care has to be given to you whether you can pay for it or not, and that causes the price to be put on other people. And then you have Medicare involved here, which is a massive government subsidy without the ability to negotiate on prices. So when you put those things together, these two industries look similar. If you tweak Medicare a little bit or you tweak the student loan thing a little bit, it's just a tweak on a behemoth. If there is inflation caused by government spending in college, it doesn't have much to do with $10,000 forgiven. There's a much, much larger issue that needs to be discussed, and that's not something that people are really comfortable discussing at this point. Because if they stopped giving these loans, a lot of people wouldn't be able to go to college. So is there a net benefit to these loans? Yes, a lot of people went to college that couldn't. Is there a problem with it? Yes, a lot of people got way too much student loans. The net benefit is there. There is a massive net benefit to having an educated population. How we're paying for it is just as much of a thorny, sticky wicket as how we're paying for public education throughout the country at any level. So if you want to get into the politics of that, we're trying to stay out of the politics and just look at, whoa, you guys are arguing about that little tiny percentage there at the end of this really big number. And you can scream and yell about it all you want, but you're really wasting energy. There's a bigger problem that needs to be discussed. And as long as you're screaming and spittle is flying, we're not going to come up with a solution. That's just destructive. We got to figure out a way of coming together on this. And I know that makes me sound like a Generation Xer. Let's compromise, everyone, please. Let's just get along. I am a Generation Xer. You're the boomer. You should come out and say, let's just get rid of all student debt, or no, charge everyone everything. Can you polarize us for a minute, please, just to be generationally accurate?
No.
You sure? Okay. All right. We don't usually represent our generations very well, so, because we're bald.
Yes. Well,
we got through that question with that very short question. How would loan forgiveness fuel inflation? With the 35-minute commentary, but hey, we're economists. We're allowed to talk. What do you have? You have a bunch of fascinating stuff.
Well, it's kind of hard to get started. It's time for commercials.
Let's do commercials, and then we'll come back with some really fascinating stuff. He's about to crack open a treasure trove of fun stuff to talk about. If you'd like to join the conversation during or after the commercial, our email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey, Charlie, or the personal wealth coach. And we will be back on the other side of these very important announcements. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff
McClure. You have, I've hyped it up, so you've got some pressure on you to make this thing fascinating. You've got a subject here that I find fascinating.
Speaking of polarization, there is a great polarization among economists and pundits about which way the economy is going. Are we headed for sustained growth? Or are we headed into a recession? And if you're following the information that comes out, the data, and we publish in the newsletter, and I could bore people to tears and have people running off the highway by giving all that data again. Suffice to say, there are the data are conflicting. And by the way, data is plural, so it is proper to say are, not is.
Unless you're talking about Star Trek, and then it's he. He is data or data.
Yes, but he never... He's data, which is different from data.
Right. Okay. So right. Data not being data. Go ahead.
Data doesn't conflict. Anyway, there are indicators that in a normal environment, a normal economic environment, the environment we have seen for decades, would indicate that we are headed full speed into a recession, and it's probably going to be a big one. For example, the inverted yield curve. Another example is housing starts, which have fallen off 9.6% in a month.
That's rather large.
That is big. And historically, housing starts are an indicator of where the economy is going. When people stop buying houses, people stop and builders stop building houses, they lay off a lot of people. And those lot of people don't get to buy things anymore and they can't find jobs. And that starts things downhill in a hurry. And it is associated with rising interest rates, which the mortgage rate has way more than doubled in a year. And as a result, the housing market is starting to cool off. And that used to be a sign that we were headed for a recession. It's not necessarily true right now. Because on the other hand, we look at durable goods orders and durable goods capital orders, which are a strong indication of which way the economy is going. What's a durable good capital order? That means a business is ordering something that's going to be around for at least 5 years.
Yeah, that's a big deal. It's like a big piece of equipment to help them make more stuff to sell you. That's a really good thing for profit long term.
Durable goods capital orders are up like 14% in a month. Wow. That indicates we're headed into a boom.
So we got
big rocking and rolling economy.
Conflicting signals here.
We have deliveries up. We have backlogs for manufacturers up. We have wages rising only 0.2% for the month, which is certainly an acceptable amount, but they're still rising. We have a near record number of new jobs created and filled in the last month. These are all indications that the economy is headed into a boom. These are the kind of things we see as we come out of a recession. We have some signals that says we're headed into a recession. We have other signals that say we're headed out of a recession in a big hurry. And they're horribly conflicting. Probably the single most profound indicator was released by the Labor Department that does GDP?
Commerce Department. Bureau of Economic Analysis at the Commerce Department, yeah.
They come out with a GDP first estimate, which was that in the second quarter, the United States economy was down on an annualized basis. Notice it wasn't down for the quarter. You can divide this by four and get a pretty accurate number. But on an annualized basis, if we went that way for the full year, the economy contracted in the second quarter by 0.9%. Then they have revised that now to in their second estimate to 0.6% on an annualized basis, which is means we're not really falling very fast. But at the same time, in the second estimate, they released something called GDI, the gross domestic income, which I refer to as the common sense GDP.
Yeah, related to what people are actually making as far as increased income, inflation adjusted. This is what we're supposed to be. It pulls out import and export and the deficit of the government.
And it also pulls out the inventory buildup or shrinkage. What it boils down to is our companies in the second quarter, did people doing business in the United States, either as corporations or as individuals, make more or less money after subtracting inflation? And the answer is, on an annualized basis, the economy on that, looking at that, was rising at a 1.4% rate in the second quarter, which is sustainable and good and healthy.
Do you mind if I just throw in two more or three more data points very quickly and then hand it, because these are just going to support you on this. The income that's being measured here in GDI, it's pretty easy to find some corroboration to that. If you look at the tax revenue to the states and to the federal government and at the local level across the country, most of their taxes come from income and sales. If income goes up, they make more money. If sales go up, they make more money. The United States government this month, July, the latest data they have, made about $7 billion more than the same month last year. However, for the year to date, the federal government has received $787 billion more in revenue than it did over the same period last year. We had a 41% increase in individual taxes. Corporate taxes are up 11%, 26% up in Federal Reserve earnings. So all of this stuff coming into the government is not coming from people losing their job or losing their income. When we look at states, in Texas, everywhere in the United States, most of the states have a massive surplus. Massachusetts is about to have to turn around and refund its citizens a large amount of money. About $3 billion, 7% of its overall revenue is going to go back out because they have a quirky law in their constitution that says if they pull in way too much money, they need to give it back. So those are some real quick points to say there's a boom going on in income that has some important aspects in play here. Okay, now go back to you.
It's different this time. It really is. Let me explain why. All of these tea leaves that economists read to determine which way the economy is likely to go in the near future and which way it's going now are based on a near steady state economy where very small fluctuations, if the economy is right at the balance, which is where it normally is, a small fluctuation that persists over a couple of months has a big meaning. However, we have just gone through a tsunami. We have just gone through a massive economic event back in the pandemic. And that massive economic event was compounded by another massive economic event, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And as a result, these shock waves are floating back and forth through the global economy, up and down. And some really, really weird stuff went on and is still going on that we have literally not seen since the beginning of World War II. We have just not seen this level of major economic shift occur in a really long time. There are no people who are out there working professionally in the investment business or in the economics business who were alive and in the business when it happened the last time around.
You used a metaphor earlier.
I'll get to that.
I think it's a great one.
It's like there was a sudden traffic stop and you're late and you've been sitting there in the traffic jam and the traffic opens up and you start down the highway where the speed limit is 70 at 100 miles an hour. And you don't realize you've gotten to 100 miles an hour until you look down and say, whoa, if I get a ticket of this, it's really going to mess me up. If I have an accident, this is really going to mess me up. And you start letting off on the accelerator and you start slowing down. Well, the rest of the traffic is slowing down too. So you start to slow down and you drop all the way back through 70 to 65. In other words, you've dropped 45 miles an hour in a very short period of time. Now, if you've been cruising along at 70, normally, the speed limit is 70, and you drop 45 miles an hour off of that, there is something seriously wrong with your car, and you are creating a traffic hazard, and this is a bona fide emergency. Turn your flashers on and get off the road. But if you drop 45 miles an hour, or if you drop 40 miles an hour or 45 miles an hour from 100, no, you're just getting back to normal, and you may slow down a little more than you want to, and then you'll speed back up again.
35 to 65.
Okay, it's 35. So you drop 35 miles an hour. Okay, you drop 35 miles an hour from 70. You're doing 35 miles an hour on an interstate, which means you're a traffic hazard. And if you can't go faster than 35 miles an hour, there's something seriously wrong with your car. Get off the road. You have an emergency. If you're going 100 and you drop 35 miles an hour, that's a completely different issue.
You might still be a traffic hazard if everybody else is trying to drive fast, but
right,
everybody else is slowing down at the same time.
We have an economy that first ground to a severe recession, severe but very short recession, and then reaccelerated out of that because of its reserves to an unsustainable rate of speed and is now slowing back down to a sustainable rate of speed. We ain't there yet. It's like we're still doing 80. Now, this is echoing back and forth, and it is compounded by the fact, for example, in Great Britain, they're expecting 18 to 20% inflation in the near future. Whoa. Europe is sliding into recession fast. And there's double reason. One, they do a lot of business with China, and China is probably going to go into recession. And the big one is the fact that Russia invaded Ukraine, which we don't feel the pain of
anywhere nearly as much
in the United States.
Yeah, anywhere near as high as what they're feeling over there.
The Europeans are, it is the equivalent of the southwestern United States, everything that used to be part of Mexico suddenly being gone in the United States and hostile because Europe got most of its petroleum from Russia. Europe does tremendous amount of trade with Russia and China. China is slipping into recession. Russia is becoming the enemy. It is causing a huge effect. Now, what's that got to do with us? We do a lot of business with Europe in the United States. We get things from Europe. We sell things to Europe. We get things from China. We sell things from China to China. And this is causing a whiplash effect through the economy. And it is really hard to tell what the future is going to hold. I can say that you should be very thankful that you live in the United States of America right now.
Yeah.
To give you an example.
Presuming you do, because we have listeners in other countries.
If you live in the United States, you are in the sweet spot, let me tell you. To give you an example, I will remember when it took $1.40 to buy a euro. Right now.
It wasn't that long ago.
The euro is 99.66 cents. You can basically it's on par with the dollar. You can
I don't have any 0.66 cents any around. I need to get some.
Yes. But if you went to Europe right now, the dollar is basically 1 euro. And from all I have been able to find, I just read some anecdotal information. If you visit the United Kingdom, they actually prefer to receive dollars than pounds. Keep your American money, folks, for America did rise again. We are whether or not people like the United States, they love the dollar right now.
And we're about out of time for this. Yes. This hour. We've got more good stuff next hour, and even continuations of what we're talking about here. Good stuff. But if you would like to talk to us off the air, you can. We actually give personalized, customized advice to people of high net worth, to foundations,
fiduciary,
and trusts.
Fiduciary investment.
Right. Exactly. Foundations, trusts, corporations, partnerships as well. Man, there's a lot to do. We also do management of portfolios.
Yeah. Yeah, we do that.
Yeah. If you'd like to contact us off the air, you contact us. Yes. If you would like to contact us off the air, the local number is
254-947-1111.
Or toll free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com if you're lazy like me. And you can read our newsletters going back lots of years. You can listen to our radio program going back a long ways. You can go anywhere where podcasts are issued and hear them. You can also contact us directly at the contact form, or through email at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com.
And if sometime you want to hear the radio program and you missed it, it's typically posted on our web page by Monday afternoon.
Until next hour, thank you very much for listening to The Personal Wealth Coach.